And it, to me, it is important for this reason. It reveals the character of practical attitude of Catholics about all subjects in general. We approach them from a negative point of view, or we have that tendency. He says it's the sweetest of sins. But we've already seen that all creatures are samples, and sex is a sample too. We have seen that the culminating image of our love for God is a sexual image, the union of bride and groom. And we even, this afternoon, used sexual intercourse as part of that sample. We said it was the greatest pleasure in human life, but only transient, only a few seconds. It's only a sample. Now, I think that we should approach the whole business of sin from a positive way, and that's exactly what I've done, if you've noticed it. Some books would tell you, you're going to go to confession, some of you at least, in a few days, and they would give you a book, and they would tell you all about sins. And some spiritual books tell people to sit down and think out, what is your special sin? What is the special sin that you're addicted to, or you find your weakness? That would be your characteristic weakness. Now, I don't believe in that, and that isn't what I think we should do. I think that what we should do whenever we want to find out our sins is to look for our captivating sample. What is or what are those creatures which attract us and which tend to seduce us? It could be sex, but there are others, too, that it could be. And sex is sweet, so it could be that. But why couldn't we put it in a different way? Why couldn't we think of sex not as the sweetest of sins, but as the sweetest of samples? I think that's the way to put it. It is a sample. I'm speaking of the attraction and the union between male and female. That's what I will take to be sex here. I'm not going to go into any biological details. But the attraction, the usually normal attraction between the male and the female, that's sexual attraction. It's spontaneous, it's immediate. When there's a group of men sitting in a room and a woman walks in, the men are immediately alert. If there's a group of women and a man walks in, the women are immediately alert. It's something so deep and so spontaneous that we really can't control that. And basically it's animal, so there's no affront in calling it lust. There is this lust is involved in it. When that animal instinct gets out of hand, it's lust, and it can easily get out of hand. But it's also connected with love. And I think it's connection with love rather than the force of the physical thing that makes it so difficult. So easy, I mean, on the one hand, and so difficult on the other. It makes it so imperious in its demand, because we may have very strong sexual tendencies, but every one of us has a strong desire for love. And combine those, and you have a very touchy situation. Strong physical sexuality and a powerful desire for love. We find that in people like a Mary Magdalene that have come down to us traditionally, or an Augustine of Hippo that have exposed themselves to the generations. This is the kind of people they are. And there's lots of people like that. There are many people who go to St. Augustine and love St. Augustine precisely for that reason. That's why they read about him and read his life. Because he gives them some fellow feeling. And so the sexual drive is connected with love, and the most imperious need in our lives is the need for love. And even after lust dies, when sex is one of those things that has, it's under the law of diminishing returns. It's a parenthesis. One writer says, Frank Sheet, it's a parenthesis in our lives. It has a beginning and it has an end within our life here on earth. And even while it continues, it's subject to the law of diminishing returns. But even after the lust disappears and the physical appetite disappears, there's still that imperious desire and need for love. The oldest of people want love. This is what they're lacking in old people's homes. This is what they need, to be wanted and loved when sex is impossible to them. And so it's this connection of lust and love, a truly human love, that makes it so powerful and so dangerous, therefore. But I don't think we should ever think of it as evil. That's been a temptation. The Manichees committed that sin. And we Catholics have been accused of being Manichees, and perhaps there is a strain of Manicheism among at least some Catholics. But no Catholic could be a Manichee. Anyone who has read and believes the first book of Genesis could never believe, never be a Manichee. Augustine is accused of being a Manichee, but I think that's a calumny. Augustine became a Manichee for the same reason that young people today became hippies. It was a protest against the society of his time. As soon as Augustine went to a master teacher of Manichaeism and found out what it was, he quit. He got away from it. He was too good a philosopher, even, apart from being a Christian, to be a Manichee. But anyway, that's by the way. But no Christian can be a Manichee and be a Christian at the same time. So I think that's largely libel, and maybe the weakness of some individual people or their propaganda, that there's this tendency. It's such a powerful drive that it could be thought to be evil. I would think of it this way. Images. I think of the Conemaugh River up here in Pennsylvania, in central Pennsylvania. Beautiful rural country river, which is dammed up at various places along the way, and the water is used to provide light and heat and energy and nourishment for the farms in central Pennsylvania. It's a great benefit to all the people up through there around Johnstown. But twice in the history of Johnstown, the dams have broken, and the water, which was so rich in its benefits to the area, became destructive and killed them and destroyed their work. It's a force which can be beneficent and can be destructive, and so can sex. It is so powerful. It is a benefit, and this is the way we must think of it, as a benefit. We have the most beautiful things in our lives. Everyone here has come through to us through the sexual union of our mothers and fathers. We have life from them. We have all that goes through life, a home, a brothers and sisters, all the joys and pleasures and happiness that we discovered in that home and experienced in that home, that came and was all a result of that sexual embrace between our parents. Vast benefits. And yet, on the other hand, every day we read in the papers of the rapes, the killings, the violence. Most violence is sex-connected. Those liberals, those people who are fighting a losing battle or fighting against violence but won't fight against the excesses of sex, they're usually non-Catholics. They want to get rid of the violence in the films, let us say, but they don't bother about the sex in the films. The Catholics take the other extreme. They want to get rid of the sex, but they don't bother about the violence. But they're linked. Most violence is sex-linked. Somehow. And if we're going to get rid of violence, we have to get rid of the excesses of sex. But you see, the world won't admit there are any excesses of sex, because that's the sweetest of the samples. and the sweetest of the sins too. So we don't control it. So because it brings benefit and is so powerful, it can also bring destruction. And therefore, we should look upon it as a great natural force, a great natural phenomenon. It has benefits and has disadvantages. And in order to share those benefits, it has to be controlled, like water has to be controlled. We speak of harnessing a stream. That's what the dam is for. That is what the sidings are for, the causeways are for, along the river, to channel the water so it can be used to provide electrical power or steam power or light or heat or water for the fertilization, the use on the farms, the farmers, becomes a benefit. But the water has to be channeled. Unchanneled, it can be destructive. Sex is the same way. It is not inherently good, not inherently evil. It is inherently good, morally neutral, physically good. But it has to be harnessed if the benefits alone are to be reaped and the evil fruits are not to be reaped. And this is why it takes controls, like chastity. We can go back to sex too, and we can see in it what we saw from the beginning in our lives, that three levels, the animal, the human, and the divine. It's an animal appetite. It's in all of us. We hide that, but it's there. There's a story about a farmer that he bred geese in his farm, and there were some visitors there one day, and they asked him, "Well, how do you tell the difference between the male and the female?" Oh, he said, "That's easy. We just put them in that yard up there and we let them work that out for themselves. This attraction is so strong, it's inherent in us, you see, this animal desire, this animal tendency. But you see, it is animal, and we have to humanize it at the very least. And when it's humanized, it can be something beautiful." Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "It drives men," and I think he included women in that word, "it drives men nobly mad." Nobly mad. That is certainly high praise. I remember reading in a novel that I read many years ago by F. Marion Crawford. It was, a romantic novel, and that I read in my youth, and I only remember this one thing about it. The remark that was said in it, he was a popular novelist at the time, that the desire of one sex to appear well in the eyes of the members of the opposite sex is one of the greatest of all civilizing features in our life. It civilizes men and civilizes women. It can. And so, humanly, when it's humanized, that can become something beautiful even on the human level. But we as Christians have the privilege and really the duty to divinize it, because we have the duty here also to get in the third element, the divine element. And this is why it has been made a sacrament. Sometimes the church is accused of downgrading marriage and of looking upon it dubiously, but the highest honor that the Catholic Church could give marriage, it has made, is in making it a sacrament on the same level of actuality as the Eucharist. There could be no higher word of praise or act of praise or honor for marriage than that. Even with its animal element, it makes it a sacrament. But with the understanding, of course, that through the sacrament, too, that is to be controlled, not only humanized, but now divinized, And as we heard from Pius the 11th the other day, it becomes a partnership in love and in the interior life, so that they help one another day by day in seeking after the highest degree of holiness. This is to divinize it. I think that the Catholic Church, far from derogating or depreciating sex or marriage, has given it the supreme honor that it can have rightly under God's providence and His creative way. And this is, I think, how we should see it. But it is important to harness it, that it may be used beneficently and sacramentalize it to place it before God. The supreme proof of this scripturally is that beautiful passage in St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, chapter 5, which was read to you, most of you who are married before the Vatican Council anyway, you all heard it. And although we have a greater liberty in choosing readings now, I don't think there's any other reading that really takes its place, that in St. Paul, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Those are the words that have revealed to us that it is a sacrament, that it has been divinized, as Christ loved the church and delivered himself up for her, that she might be holy and without blemish. So should husbands love their wives as their own bodies. The women nowadays are protesting vociferously against the first words of that passage, wives, obey your husband. Well, I won't comment on that, but whatever teeth there are in it are promptly removed whenever he says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and delivered himself up for it. The model, the sign of Christian marriage is the sacrificial death of Christ on the cross. And this is the model then that is given to a Christian husband and wife for their marriage. A truly sacrificial love. And this is the way we should live it on. And marriage then too is given to us as the supreme sample of our own union with God. God is the bridegroom and we are the bride. Everybody loves a bridegroom, they say. Everybody loves a lover, and I guess whether it's the bridegroom or the bride, we love it. We all enjoy going to a wedding. In parishes where the parish life is rich, a wedding can be an important event. In my parishes, I always invited the whole parish to every wedding and tried to make it a parish event, because it is a family event, a parish event. And everyone's welcome. We would give the bridal couple the privileged places, but everyone was made welcome, and everyone was invited to join in the celebration, the singing, because we were celebrating one of our own parishioners, our own children, one of our own daughters, usually. And this is, we all should join. And my parish, they responded to that enthusiastically. And that's the way I think it should be. And the bride and the groom then standing up there in front of the church, they signalize our love for God. They're a sign for us. Every sacrament is a sign, and they are a sign to us of the love of God for His people. And therefore we see that love exemplified each time we see a bride and groom in front of the altar pledging themselves to each other in all solemnity. This is it. This is what we were taught in that book, the Song of Songs, in the Old Testament. Even the Jews saw it at least dimly that way. And that's what that book is all about. As I said, in a way, it's too bad we don't have a similar book in the New Testament. The only book we have is that letter to the Ephesians, where it says that so clearly. Of course, Christ often spoke of himself as a bridegroom. All those parables, when he says there's a bridal feast, you know who he's talking about, don't you? He now is the representative of God, Yahweh, the bridegroom. Christ is the bridegroom for us. And so all those parables, they are indirectly an indication that he is the Son of God. You can understand why the Jews would resent that. They're blasphemous by their standards because he was claiming to be Yahweh. Yahweh was the bridegroom. He was claiming a special relationship to Yahweh. And so they could only regard it as blasphemous. But the church has given us this as a model for us, and to see our own supernatural destiny in the light of this union of bride and groom. Now, that's the way I think we should see sex, in that light. I think that's the church's position on sex. You know, we don't often hear it that way. Why then chastity? Chastity are the damned. Chastity is what holds that in check. We need chastity for the unmarried, and we need chastity for the married, so that this ideal can be preserved. In the church, we often usually think of chastity in relation to religious, but the typical case of chastity is the married person. The religious is an exceptional person in the church, not the normal person, not the normal member. The married chastity, and there is such a thing as married chastity. Married chastity could be defined in the words of the old marriage ritual too, as fidelity to one embrace. In a day when men and women have 9 or 10 spouses, that is not an easy thing to do, and not even a frequent thing. Fidelity to one embrace. That's married chastity. And it's through this commitment that this powerful sexual urge can be harnessed and put completely at the service of love, even when the sexual urge wears out and wears down, and can serve, even in its decay and its residue, the love which was intended from the start to serve and keep them bound in love with one another. This is what Christian marriage can effect, and this is why I still believe in the indissolubility of marriage. One of my visitors said to me today, you have a reputation as a traditionalist. Well, I do have a tradition. My religion goes back to a person named Jesus Christ, and these are the things that he taught. And I don't think that any council has dispensed us from belief in these traditions. A tradition is something that's handed on. And this has been handed on from Christ. What is not handed on from Christ, we might be able to modify or even discard. It may be a false growth. But what comes from him, no. That belongs always. After the 25th Vatican Council, if there is one, why, that will be it. And so I think that these are the things that we have to keep alive, even indissolubility in our world. In the church. And fidelity. Human life is not worthwhile if there's no fidelity. If we can't rely, if no one is trustworthy, if no word is valuable, if there's no sacredness at all, what value is human life then? So, I recommend these things to your thoughts, and that will be all now for this evening. We'll meet downstairs. I guess we'll say our night prayers. We can go at it promptly, and we'll meet then tomorrow morning. God bless you.